Trap, the Star Trek podcast. I'm Josh Look.
I'm Jeff Luce.
Al Rose.
Shelly Rose.
Today we're talking about the Man Trap.
First episode aired.
Right.
I got the right here.
Jeff's got his notes.
In a perfect world, what we would have now is Shelly do the computer readout voice from Star Trek. The Man Trap. It aired September 8th, 1966. That was 2 years before I was born. Al was a teenager at that time. Shelley's age is a mystery for the ages that shall not be discussed. And, of course, Josh was...
I had a way to go.
Man. His father wasn't even old enough to produce the sperm. So it was directed by a guy named Mark Daniels, who no one knows his name, no one remembers him, but this guy from the 50s to the 80s worked like a dog for Hollywood. According to IMDb, he has 110 directorial credits on TV.
Wow.
And that's not episodes.
So the shows that
he worked on. So, like, he did multiple episodes of 110 different shows,
wow.
Not the least of which was I Love Lucy. He directed most of them, which is probably how he got the job on Star Trek, being a Desilu production.
Oh, right.
Of course.
Right? And he did a lot of Star Trek.
Yeah, he
did. Yeah. And we got to speak about the writer. Writer, I got some things I want to say about the writer.
I'm sure you do.
His name is George Clayton Johnson. And his major claim to fame, other than writing this episode, is the fact that he co-wrote the book Logan's Run.
Right.
And I make the point that it is the book,
not the movie.
And as I recall, you're a big fan of the movie, but not a fan of the book.
I love the movie. It is one of the best science fiction movies of all time, despite the cheesy, lame-o special effects. The story alone gives me I got chills. I got goosebumps out.
I still have your DVD, and we're gonna work up to watching that.
Well, you ought to. Well, let me tell you a little about George Clayton here. If you've seen a picture of this dude.
Yeah, he's a hippie.
No, he's not a hippie. He wants to be Walt Whitman.
Is that what he is?
Jesus. Yeah, freaking hippie. Totally. And I'm sorry, George Clayton Johnson, but your book, Logan's Run, was one of the worst science fiction books I have ever read in my life. And it amazes me to this day that it could be turned into the greatest, or one of the greatest, science fiction movies I've ever seen. So, George Clayton Johnson, I hate you, but I love you.
Well, I tell you... What's a pretty nice thing to be able to put on your resume as a writer? Ever seen the first episode of that show, Star Trek?
Yeah,
I wrote that.
I did it with 11, too.
Which, yes. And which we should say...
The story that Ocean's 11 is based on. Again. A shitty book.
Right.
Into a good
book. Right.
So... Let's also talk about not the first episode filmed.
Right, of course.
Right? It's the fifth one, not including the cage. But it's the one that they decided to air first. And watching it, looking at it, I can see why.
Yeah.
The characters are kind of there. They're more who they're supposed to be than they are in the first
all their relationships are established before the first commercial break.
Yeah.
Right. The Kirk Bones relationship is right there in the opening scene.
Sure,
when
right.
He's like ribbing him and Kirk is such a dick, you know?
Kirk pulls up the sweets
and he's like, yeah, why'd you bring her some flowers? Ah.
I like the use of his the long, dry, dead grass.
Right. Right.
Bring a girl flowers.
Right, because I'm a dick.
Kirk is a douche through the entire He's such a douche.
No,
yes.
That is the uninitiated view.
We will talk about that later.
But the episode itself, is, yeah, it's really solid. And then I'll tell you what else I was thinking about in this episode. Let me outline the story for you, and you tell me if it sounds familiar. So there are these guys exploring ancient ruins, distant on a distant planet, far away from humanity, and the military sends out a ship, as they have to check on them, make sure that they're okay medically. But they get there, and the people say, go away, we don't want you here. And the captain says, I'm sorry, we have to, and we have to come and check you out. And they check him out, but then people start mysteriously dying, and then it turns out that the culprit was actually one of the people that they came to check. Sounds familiar?
Forbidden Planet?
Yeah, right. Forbidden Planet! Right?
The basic outline is the same, but there are subtle differences.
Major Hollywood production.
What year did Forbidden Planet come out? What year was that?
59.
It's 6 years? 7 years?
Yeah. Still. You know, this sold once. You know how Hollywood works.
Yeah.
This sold once, they'll buy it again.
God bless that George Clayton Johnson, that vision.
But wonderful episode,
and every character has their own little
moment.
Character, and you find, right. And it's something personal about them.
Yes.
Yeah. Because right, and I think that again, that's why it's such a good first episode, because you get those interactions that are really showing who the characters are. That the thing that the network didn't like about Star Trek was they always said that it wasn't enough action; it was too cerebral. And this is a very cerebral episode.
It is.
There's two action scenes that we can talk about, but one of them is that final scene, which is fantastic.
Right. That scene sitting there on the bridge saying he's thinking about the buffalo.
No, that's pretty great. I'm talking about McCoy's
to shoot the woman he loves.
McCoy's has taken one of those little red pills. You'll sleep, right? but he wakes up and he's all groggy, and the salt monster comes running in as Nancy. Just, Leonard, help me, they're going to kill me. He's waking up, he's like, oh, don't worry. And then in walks Kirk with this look on his face and a phaser, and it's just this, it's amazing, and you can see why McCoy is like, whoa, what are you doing? You're gonna hurt her. And then she goes and she puts her hands on him and she's doing that thing. And Spock comes in at that bit where he's two-handed punching her. Is this Nancy? Oh my god.
Would she be able to take this?
Right.
Yeah, that's cool.
Would she be able to take this, right? And then she flies, she flings him across the room. And then she goes to put her hands on her again. And then she makes the fatal mistake of not maintaining her illusion so that McCoy is able to phaser her.
Right.
God help me, he says, right?
Yeah.
It's just fantastic. He's up against the line and shooting his ex-love. But that's such a dramatic scene. Oh, and Kirk screaming, And then when you finally see the salt monster and it's got those long fingers with the suction cups on his hands.
Right.
And you understand first like where the modeling comes
from. Exactly, yeah.
And you saw a couple of times that she goes to reach for people's faces.
Starts at the first time she sees McCoy, she does it.
Exactly. I noticed that for the first time watching it. It's beautiful. She just kind of takes him by the face.
I did notice that when I watched it.
It's really wonderful. The other thing that I was looking at that's really wonderful is as the alien jumps from body to body, that you can always tell who it is because of the knuckle bite.
The knuckle bite. There are a number of what I think are pretty remarkable details that you really only pick up on in repeat viewings. Mm-hmm. First off, in the scene where they first find Darnell, they go out to go see what Nancy's screaming about.
Mm-hmm.
You look at Kirk, and you look at Bones, and you look at Professor Crater. They're sweating.
Yes.
Heavily.
Yes, I did notice that in HD.
Nancy, not sweating at all.
That's interesting.
Yeah. Because she just sucked the salt out of Darnell. She's less affected by the heat than they are.
No, she's also from the planet.
She's also from the planet. Right.
You're right. I didn't know that.
I don't necessarily think that that's by accident.
It is.
I don't think it was necessarily, okay, we can show sweaty men, but we're not going to show a sweaty woman.
No, you know what I mean?
The way you gotta look at it, and I don't know where I read this, but I've read it a number of times. Everything you see on the screen is there on purpose.
Yeah.
There's too much money involved for half-assed reaction work.
Yeah.
So they do appear sweaty. It's not because they didn't want them to. It's because they went up and sprayed them with a spray.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah. That's true. I think we should talk about a couple things that we may have picked up on that we think is either funny or interesting.
Right. Funny or interesting. I like to think of myself as the myth buster.
Right.
A lot of bullshit myths about Star Trek. Even Shelley here saying that Kirk's a dick. He's not a dick.
In this episode.
But first thing I want to point out, the red shirt. We've all heard about it. The red shirt is the guy who gets it
right
first. The very first red shirt is blue.
Yeah, that's true. And I think
the second red shirt
is also
blue, and the third red shirt is gold/green.
Mm-hmm.
No red shirt's died. The red shirt
tradition has not yet been established.
No.
I think that there's a number of things, though, that have kind of become myths about Star Trek. And I think it's kind of for the same reasons that Dracula's not scary anymore. In our mindset in this day and age, it's so permanently ingrained into us to some extent that we've kind of like, things have gotten blown out of proportion. The red shirt thing, Kirk being a womanizer.
Yeah.
There's a long list of things that you could bring up, but that, I thought about the same thing. There's not a single red shirt that dies in this episode.
No, we'll
probably keep a running tally of red shirts who actually
all right, we should do that. We should keep a running tally. But I think that we can keep a running tally of Kirk being a womanizer.
Three.
Too. Oh, no.
Three. It's not very many times.
Three confirmed times in the entire run of the show that he sleeps with a woman.
Nonetheless, there are times when you get to see him pour on his Kirk charm.
He can be charming.
But I will say this, every time he does that, it is for a purpose other than getting laid.
That we actually see.
That's true. All right, we're going to have to keep track of that.
We'll see you getting laid.
All right.
Wrigley's pleasure planet.
Right.
You look just like a girl I left.
Why would you leave Wrigley's pleasure planet?
Just abandon the energy.
Translate that into 21st century terms.
Yeah.
You look like a whore who sucked my dick. I was sure that you drunk off my ass on Wrigley's pleasure planet.
And then gave me some gum.
Yeah. Yeah. No wonder why Kirk kicks him the hell out after that. He's like, really, Darnell?
Well, no. Even McCoy goes, he's like, little less mouth.
That's
awesome. He's like,
yeah.
Frickin' Rube Darnell.
Darnell had it coming.
He earned it.
We say that because not only does he bring that up, but right before, I really like this about this episode. The setup, right? The pre-intro credits setup. And the original Trek is really great at that.
Yep.
Yes.
Next Generation is really not good at it.
No, the cold start. The cold start is a hard thing to do.
It is. Yeah, it is. This one, the pre-credits intro, the last thing you see is what, you know, what Darnell sees as Nancy Crater walking off, and she says something about it being hot. And Darnell's like, yeah, I'm going to follow her.
He peeks in to make sure Kirk's not going to catch him, right?
She throws that little rag at him.
Right. Follow orders or follow the blonde chick.
You're on guard duty, but instead of that, I think I'll go bang out the wife of the guy who runs this planet while I'm on duty.
The guy that's going to fix me up if I ever...
If I'm ever
in a really bad way.
Yeah, I was feeling bad about Darnell earlier today, but now...
No. Also, the first time that... this is something that I think is kind of legitimate. Bones saying he's dead, Jim.
I noticed that, too.
First time he says it.
Yeah.
Let's go to some character stuff. Is that kind of...
Sure.
Character stuff.
Big three first.
Big three, obviously. Kirk.
All right, so we've already established that Jim is a dick in the beginning.
He was not a dick. He was definitely a douche more than...
He's completely harassing McCoy. He's going through a tough time.
He says something like that all the time. That doesn't make it... Well, I'm a dick, but it doesn't make you guys.
I'm sorry. Okay, having watched the whole series, I was really struck by Kirk telling Bones to stop thinking with his glands and think about your job. When you've already, if you've seen the whole series, you think down the line, there's the episode where he lets Scotty basically play grab ass all over the Enterprise.
That's far in the future from here.
Right?
What I thought was interesting about that whole stop thinking with your glands, you fucking asshole, we got a job to do, is that Kirk is fun when it's time to be fun.
Right.
But when it's time for business...
Right.
It's business. If the ship is on the line, if the crew is on the line...
If there's a mystery afoot.
You got one priority. Yeah, if you got a bellyache from a mystery because Darnell was out trying to get some monster nookie and ended up losing all his salt, you pretty much got rolled by a space truck stop troll is what happened.
Pretty much.
That assaults one.
Right, but he's busy.
If that happens, all bets are off.
Right, but...
Put your personal shit aside.
Although, he apologizes later, which is interesting.
Because they're friends.
Right.
And you call him a dick, but that's not being a dick. If men bust... women too. Women and men... We bust balls. That's how we show affection. He's like teasing him, like, yeah, here's some weeds for your girlfriend, you pussy.
Plum.
Right.
Plum.
Nickname given him by the actual Nancy Crater. We'll discuss in a minute. But he's not a dick. They're pals, and he's busting balls, which I, as a professional ball buster...
you can respect that.
I can actually respect that. That's absolutely true. All right, so go on, Josh. What else you got?
Other Kirk moments. Anyone else notice how, okay, I find a dead body, Kirk goes right in to prying his fingers into Darnell's mouth?
Oh, no, you can see it sticking out.
I see it sticking out? I didn't pick up.
Yeah, he's got like a cactus sticking out of his mouth. And
It's a Borgia cast.
It hasn't been chewed. It's been kind of crammed in there with a plunger. You want to pull that out and take a look at it.
Before we move into Spock,
yeah,
I want to talk about the Kirk-Spock relationship. in this fantastic scene where they're going after Professor Crater. And he's got the the old style old style phaser from the before shots. There's just this great moment between the two of them where Kirk starts talking to Crater and he's I'm armed or whatever, and Kirk looks at Spock and Spock just nods.
Yeah.
And Kirk goes just keep talking to him as Spock fades off into the background to try and go around him. Yeah. It's like this thing that's like, we know each other so well, we don't even need to talk. Speak it.
You kind of see a little bit before, too, when he gets called to the infirmary. Bones calls him, he says, I don't think I want to put it over the speaker. Kirk gets out of his chair, and he gives a little nod to Spock, who's off camera.
Right.
And then you see Spock falling.
They're at
that level where, like, we don't even need to talk about
this. It's great, the relationship. Yeah. But
it's very cool, because you don't really get a whole lot of the two of them in this episode.
No, you don't. You have that one scene where Uhura says to Spock, though one of them is dead, it could be, the captain, the closest thing you have to a friend. So
that
kind
of
said.
That's sort of a gimmick. That's cheap right there. That's said so you know
that they're friends. Right.
It's also the sixth episode of production, too. So, really.
Right. Fifth?
Fifth.
We're not gonna
and what I'm saying here is it's not establishing the story. It's like Uhura mouthing these words that are specifically so you know that they're pals.
You know that they're, that whole scene, as wonderful it is and as sexy as Uhura is in there. Tell me about your planet Vulcan and the full moon, right? That.
Why is he telling him to get back to her post is what I want to know. Why is he entertaining that?
Right? So let's move on to Spock.
Let's move on to Spock.
Right. Yeah. There is that really, we've talked
very
about
cool
it already.
Thing
that
about
very
Spock.
Cool first scene.
Yeah, you gotta talk about the scene where Uhura and Spock. Uhura leaves her station, she comes over to flirt with Spock because she's
flirts with Spock.
Now we gotta assume that she knows how Spock is going to respond. She's having a little bit of fun with him. Like, tell me about the moon. He says, Vulcan has no moon. He's completely perplexed by the question.
I'm not
fantastic.
Surprised.
Fantastic.
And
then the other major scene with Spock in the episode is, of course, the final climactic scene where they're confronting the salt monster, and Kirk or Spock runs in and says, to paraphrase, they're killing the captain for shoot McCoy, you weenie.
That sounds like
but of course, we're trained to, talk about Star Trek myths, we're trained to think of Spock as emotionless, and for the most part. But the way he says they're killing the captain is at the top of his lungs, very emotional. Right. So right off the bat, you have established, A, that they're friends through this discussion he has with Uhura and his logical outlook. But you're also given the fact that it's a facade, a thin veneer. He is in a time of stress where he sees his friend about to be destroyed.
He will.
It's total emotion.
Right.
And then, of course, the awesome space judo move of the two-fisted bitch.
Because you're Nancy Handel.
Because it doesn't matter that you can't get momentum or leverage that way. You've got both arms.
Right.
So it must be stronger.
Yeah.
You bitch slap somebody with your hands clasped together, you are bitch slapping somebody.
Bones. This is kind of a Bones episode.
Bones episode.
You know what's really amazing is when you see him when he transforms and he becomes kind of feminine. And I think I just thought it was really interesting to put that as a first episode to have an actor playing a character that is going to be playing for many episodes, but then also have him be playing.
Yeah, you're right. He walks different. He holds himself to him when he's doing it. That was pretty good.
I think all the actors that, you know, that Nancy turns into, or the salt monster turns into,
they did all.
There's such a great noticeable difference.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Green is a creepy motherfucker.
Yeah. Green is a creep. Yeah. Green's a creep, and the guy that hits on her is a creep.
Oh, he's spooky.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
He's spooky.
He speaks Swahili.
Yeah. Right.
Well, let's get through McCoy, and we'll talk about some of the minor
characters. Right,
McCoy, greatest McCoy moment. Who's the establishing McCoy? When he's checking out Dr. Crater, and then Dr. Crater thinks he's done, but he wants to look at his mouth. He's like, dump the machines. He's I'll still put my trust in that house.
Anti-technology Piccadillo was established right away.
Yeah.
And later, when you see him after he's taking the red pill in his quarters, he's got real books on his shelf.
Right. Yeah, that's true. Only time we ever see McCoy's quarters in the entire series is here, by the way.
That's true.
Yeah.
We see some good, wholesome American things still in, you know, this far in the far future. The only thing was missing was a styrofoam cup.
It was there.
Yeah. Coffee in the styrofoam.
Yeah, it's got everything. It's got styrofoam cups.
Right before they go to the
borderline sexual harassment, when Janice Rand walks by and the other guys are like, "How'd you like her personally?"
I want to mention that too. But it's so funny because, you know, here we are, and even Shelley was talking about that. Here's the show that brought, you know, women women were respectable and
men.
And then they still have to get that line. Not even her. That.
Yeah.
For your personal feelings.
Let's put the political correctness aside.
you always do, Jeff.
Naval vessel, when there's a good looking woman that walks by two male crew members, if they don't turn to each other and say something,
that ain't gonna
drop a boom.
That ain't gonna work.
But I think that's part of it. That's what they were saying.
Here we have one of the classic human themes that will carry through the entire series, is that human nature is human nature.
Right. All right.
They don't question
any woman's rank or her ability.
Yeah.
But when a fine piece of ass walks by, a super beehive cone on the top of her head.
I'm a little old-fashioned, but I really feel that's one of the greatest things about Star Trek is that women and men can be professional and successful and respected, and they can also be really hot.
Yep. I don't want to make a lot of references to the Next Generation. I want to be comparing the two because there's really no comparison.
They're not the same.
But I think it's interesting that original Trek, there are schlubs. There are gnomes. There are crewman.
Right.
The Next Generation has nobody below an ensign, and an ensign is an officer.
It's true. In
naval
They got all those women and children, so.
Yeah, well, the school teachers. Yeah. But what I'm saying here is it's good to see, because Roddenberry actually was in World War II. He flew bomber missions over Japan. So he has some military training. So it's nice to see that there are the overall wearing grease monkey.
Mm-hmm.
And there's also a dude in a hazmat suit who gets eaten.
It's true, I saw that.
Right. There's just guys in all kinds of weird costumes running through the halls.
Space stuff. There's some space stuff here.
There's some space stuff.
There's a lot of space stuff.
It's like nuclear ship. It reminds me of nuclear ship stuff early on. Like,
Like, the guy working in the engine room has got the hazmat
suit. Right, but that hazmat suit is kind of space stuffy. And it's in the middle of the episode where there's a lot of space stuff, as I called it. It was hey, why don't you go chase an asteroid? Something that Janice Rand says. And it's like, oh, has he gone space happy?
Yeah. Right, space happy.
Not just happy.
Space celery.
Space happy.
Space celery has red leaves. Just so you know.
Why is she using celery?
That was the thing that I noticed. Janice Rand, she's standing there in the hallway, not really sure what she's doing. She's got a plate of food.
Isn't she bringing the food to somebody?
I'm like, yeah, she's bringing the food to someone. She's just standing in the hallway. She's not doing anything, Jeff. I know you love her.
I do.
But hear me out. She's standing there, not really doing much of anything. Maybe she's waiting for the elevator.
Turbo lift, dude.
Right. Eat someone else's food.
Right.
Eat someone else's food.
I thought it was her.
No, she brings it to Sulu.
That's right. She brings it
several bites of his celery, space celery.
And there's not that much space celery there in the first place.
And Green comes over and sees her as she
People
can't see that motion.
Jeff. Right. They can't. Radio, right?
We're going to use CGI.
She shakes. After she takes the first bite of celery, she shakes the salt on. Green's there. Green goes to reach for it, and she slaps his hand like, get the fuck out of here.
Right.
Who are you to talk, Janice Rand? You're eating Sulu's celery.
What the fuck?
I will say this. When Janice and Sulu interact, they are friends.
They are friends.
And so, is there a girl on that spaceship that's going to have a piece of my celery?
Right.
You know what? We've disagreed on a lot of things through the years. But I gotta say, I do not find her attractive. Janice Rand.
I can't get past the beehive, man.
I'm stuck as a board too when I see her.
No, there is no. There is no sultriness. There is no sexiness to her ever. I don't see it.
What?
Her is so sexy. There's a way that she moves when she's talking to Spock. We were going to have a section of the show that was the space babe.
This episode
doesn't really have a space babe, but it was the first time that the world saw Uhura and Janice Rand. So that's a pretty good one. The one that Darnell sees isn't so bad.
She's kind of weird looking, but I would agree.
She's not like sexy, but she's a pretty girl.
She's
a pretty girl.
You take her home for the night, but you marry Janice. Right?
Yes.
Because she'll bring you food.
And bring you celery. Pre-masticated space celery.
On that note, let's switch to, after we're done talking about babes, Sulu.
Glorified bus driver.
Glorified bus driver. Not in this episode, however.
No, but he is on the bridge later.
We first meet Sulu. He's in the Bobby lab.
Right.
Doing...
Who knows what?
Space botany. Later on, when Kirk is down on the planet and he calls up to the ship, it's Sulu who answers. So he's established in this episode as in a position of authority. Perhaps space botany, more hobby than a career.
No, it's not there.
Is
that?
Yeah.
Why do you put the botanist in charge of the bridge?
We have no idea who Sulu is yet. He hasn't really been developed yet.
Am I projecting?
I think you are. You're trying to make a place for him where really he's just we need an Oriental guy.
Okay.
Asian.
We need an Asian guy.
Right. Yeah. So let's move on to one of the things that Star Trek often gets
Lambasted for?
Lambasted for is its props, its set pieces.
All right, so I want to talk about a favorite prop, and we've already talked a little bit about this. But first of all, this is the first time any of us saw phasers. Like those phasers.
Yeah, it's true.
Even though the handles seem to be a different color.
Quite a different color.
I don't know what's up with that. But the phaser and the change in the phaser from the
Cage. That was genius. Genius. He's been on the planet for 5 years. Right. He's got the old stuff.
More... He needs to have... Yeah, something different.
We have this leftover
from the Cage.
Right. I think that was more planned than that.
I don't know, but it's beautiful. It's so cool. He's got that cool looking gun. Think about what you're saying here. Nobody that was watching this episode of The Man Trap had ever seen the Cage or the Menagerie.
I suppose.
Right? So...
All right, so Shelley is a design person. From a purely aesthetic point of view, which looks more antique? The phaser held by Captain Kirk or the phaser held by Crater? With the round barrel and the clickety-clickety.
I'm with Al that they were just leftovers.
It needed to be a different gun than what they had.
Okay.
Right.
Now, the other thing that I think is really cool...
They had already made...
Is it a lot? I mean, like this is a time in the show's history where a lot of the details aren't really developed, but already we get that Kirk, the Federation phasers have different settings,
right?
Right.
You know what I mean? Like
you're just
set yours to a quarter power, and mine's on stuff.
Right. That's true.
One funny thing about this episode, speaking of the phasers, Crater gets blasted by the stun setting.
Right. Yeah.
Why does it make a Western bullet?
I know. It's the only sound effect that we have in stock. I don't know.
I think I read that it's actually in reverse, but it doesn't sound any different. It really doesn't. I read that somewhere, that the sound effect for the phaser is a ricocheting bullet in reverse, but it still sounds like a ricochet.
It's a really bad effect.
It is pretty bad.
And they speed up the film when he kind of falls.
Right, and they don't even use that in the final scene when they shoot the salt monster there.
Right, yeah.
Well, because it was set on the stun.
That's the sound of a ricocheting bullet. Is the sound of a stun phaser? Craziness. And talking about Western and props, that they're all still wearing those like leather gun belts.
They really
make them look like cowboys when they're walking around. Later on, they hide that.
They wear them later, but they're black.
Right, they're black and you can't see them.
And they're not on an angle.
Right. They're not thick.
I think you're stepping on Shelley's toes here. Wardrobe guru.
People notice.
All right, so we all agree best prop is the phaser.
Absolutely.
You know, it's the first time we see it.
What a question. The phaser, iconic. Not the shitty little tab phaser from later episodes.
Right.
But the handheld pistol phaser, fantastic.
Do you mean a phaser type 1 phaser?
Oh, communicator. That's right. That's
And here comes and it's big. It's big. It has that really cool gold grill.
Right.
It really catches the eye.
I would say
definitely second place is the communicator.
Yeah, those are really cool. These are the first times you see them.
Right.
All right, worst prop.
Worst prop is Sue's plant,
no doubt.
It's hysterical.
The gloved hand as the planet goes, wee, wee. It's and it goes, space. The plant has to make sound.
And it's okay. The plant, it kind of looks okay until then. Right. Like, then you can't really tell that it's a hand.
You can't tell.
It's the pink glove plant. Look at how the pink glove plant.
It's a great idea as a sentient plant that runs away from the salt monster. Love
right.
It.
It yes. Has a he, by the way, right?
It's a he. It's according, a he. According to my girl,
right, to your,
Janice Rand.
Yeah,
right. It's a male.
And we're done with the effects. I want to talk for a minute about the CGI. Obviously, there are differing opinions on this. I love the CGI.
I think
all
so.
That.
I think that there's two opinions. There's people who like it and people who are idiots.
I know, and yeah. I usually.
that's basically what it boils
down. I'm a traditionalist. I'm an old man. I like things to stay the same.
But for these,
I love the new CGI stuff.
It's so tasteful.
It really is.
It still looks old.
It's not pervasive. Where is it in this episode other than the opening shot of the planet?
Anytime it's not a lot of it. It's very tasteful and. The clouds on the planet.
Yeah.
And the Enterprise kind of glowing red because it's light reflected.
Yeah.
Oh my god, thank you.
So great.
But also, there's an establishing scene of the planet.
Yeah.
And it's a CGI thing, and it's like all the runes. It's really great.
It's like a desert and the stone.
Really bring you like, wow, look at this, a planet with like this ancient ruins of an ancient civilization, because you know that would be cool.
That's I'm sure that I've said it to you guys, but I'll say it here. This is something George Lucas should really watch and take notes on.
Yeah.
Before you defecate all over your work.
Overloaded,
modern day looking, bullshit, useless special effects. This is how you do it and update it and make it look good.
That's
and keep it tasteful.
That's the whole subject
for
the Fuck You George Lucas podcast.
Yeah, exactly.
You know what else I think is really great about the, that really makes it is how fantastic the sound effects are. Because the sound effects haven't been changed.
Right.
And so when you get that ship rope and it's... Really, really wonderful.
Yeah.
Wonderful job. The CGI...
It only
subtle,
adds...
But fantastic
it only adds
on
entire,
in this episode.
The entire series run.
Yeah.
Props to do costumes.
Costumes.
Yeah, costumes is show.
This is your area of expertise.
I mean, one thing I just noticed was this is, I think, the only episode where you see that wide variety of costumes being used. It's like you mentioned, you see the guy in the jumpsuit, the guy in the hazmat suit, and there's a scene where people are running, and you can see the old costumes from Where No Man's Before. There's like, because that's what I'm saying,
so
as you can see, they obviously...
Because they didn't have that many.
They hadn't built as many of the new uniforms, so they threw those on. There's a woman in pants.
Right, that's great.
Huh.
I saw that. Yeah, there's just one of those, like, someone running through the hall, and it's a woman wearing pants, and I'm thinking they... Because someone's like, well... How come in the future women all wear short skirts? Well, they don't.
Look, this one wears pants. Why do women in the future wear short skirts? Because they can.
Right. Because it's on network TV.
Well, here's a question.
I could see that would have been a little startling to an audience at that point of time.
Oh, absolutely.
Because I'm looking at it now, and as a child I didn't question it, but now I'm looking at it and going, holy cow.
I read somewhere where they
skirts are short.
Yes, they are.
What's, you heard his real name, the Nichols.
Yeah. They do an interview with her, and that's brought up. It's like, do you think it was demeaning for women to wear mini skirts in the future? And she's like, no. And they're like, why? She's like, because everyone was wearing mini skirts at that
time. Right.
Right. It was just what women wore, and we liked it.
Right.
God bless America, 1966. Here's my question for you. We see McCoy on his bed. He's got his black t-shirt on.
Yep.
The inference here is that the uniform is actually two pieces.
Right.
A black t-shirt.
Yeah.
With the colored thing pulled over it. You know, right. Everybody gets the black, and depending on what department you're in, you get the colored shirt.
Yeah.
However, if you look at them at any other time, it's clearly a mock
black thing.
Actually, it's not.
It is. I looked afterwards.
Did you?
I did.
Because there is the scene where Spock gets thrown into the bookcase by the salt monster, and his shirt gets lifted up far enough to see that he's wearing a black shirt underneath as well.
So maybe that's something that they change later on.
Maybe.
Because, I mean, you see the close-ups when they film it, and it's clearly so...
Well, they've got to make it so that if...
It's a zipper, because you have to remember that... polyester double knit had not been invented yet. They couldn't have fabric that was... You couldn't have a shirt at that point in time where the neck would stretch enough to go over your head. So you had to have an opening somewhere to have something that close fitting yet. And so what they did is they tried to hide the zipper in the shoulder.
See, that's why we keep her around.
Right? Shelly, how do you feel about the salt monster costume?
Gorgeous.
You like it?
Beautiful. The mask, the hands, the little
it is really
dress.
Cool.
It's wonderful, the little leech teeth.
I love the leech teeth on the hands.
Yeah.
On the hands,
the suction cup thing is
so genius.
Yeah. And they really, and it was. You know, even though it was a monster, it was a feminine monster.
It was,
it's true. Yeah, little rope dress on.
Did I have
the long white hair?
Yeah.
And they gave it sort of a feminine. Even with all that fur, it had sort of this. And when it died, and she just slumped there.
Right.
She just looked so sad and just like this. I mean. Very humanized, almost.
Yeah.
When you turn that face away, the figure.
Yeah.
Heartbreaking moment.
My
heart was not broken. I was cheering.
No, really?
It's
I
know.
I was thinking about the Buffalo.
Yeah.
I was not thinking about the Buffalo.
One minute, I gotta tell you.
Saying.
No, when I watched this for the first time, I was very young. I didn't know any television tropes. I couldn't, you know, there was nothing. I was a blank slate. And the first time I watched this, I was convinced that Kirk and those guys, they were the bad guys. And they were like killing this nice lady who turned into this nice fuzzy monster for no reason. Listen. McCoy's sitting there with Crater at the table going, well, why don't we just give her salt? Just that's all she wants. Why don't we just give it to her? And Noah's like, oh yeah, that's a good idea. Let's just give her a big pile of salt. She'll stop killing people. Send her home. No, they have to kill her for no good reason.
For me, it was quite a shock. I mean, like, I didn't watch this episode until maybe 5 years ago for the first time. That's when I first started watching the show. And, you know, you kind of, for someone my age, you know, growing up in, like I said, with those things that's kind of ingrained into our cultural DNA at this point, we have a certain expectation of Star Trek. To watch this episode and find that it's not that at all, and it's because of this last scene. You know, I mean, like, there's
there's some things that kind of dated in there, you know, like Spock's two-handed, you know.
It's not dated, that's awesome.
It's awesome, but it's also kind of one of those things that's just kind of like, so this was TV back then. It's not like it is now, you know. To find that it's what I am looking for in science fiction, you know. I think that's a heartbreaking moment.
It is. Yeah.
And it's a great back. Performance.
Yeah,
by the person.
Everybody.
Yeah.
Everybody.
But yeah, coming around back to costumes, I think part of that is that they were able to make a monster that was visually sympathetic and visually feminine, even though at the same time really scary and horrifying at the same time.
A lot of that
and how it makes sense too as to how it functions.
Body posture when he shoots her isn't, you know, arms up coming to kill somebody. It's a very submissive pose.
It is.
He's looking over her shoulder with her hands outstretched as if wanting something.
Yeah.
And kind of hunched over like a dog that's been beat.
Yeah.
How are you not affected by that?
Because it was a killer.
So what did we learn?
What did we learn?
What did we learn?
What is the message of this episode, to my mind? The message of the episode clearly is the question of, is all life of equal value? Or are humans inherently more valuable than other creatures? Now, you get Crater, he speaks about, came to this planet and it killed my wife. Now, I was kind of mad, I was going to kill it, but then I thought to myself, creature still wants to live, it's just trying to survive. And really, there's no difference between my wife and this creature. Who am I to choose one over the other? And on the surface, you're nodding to yourself and you're thinking, that kind of makes sense. Because it's a thinking creature and wants to survive. Who can blame
him? He uses the same skills that we would have used. You know, kind of like,
just like
they establish right away in his speech that mankind doesn't eat.
Well, that's a little later when they're on the board. But the first time he's talking about it is after he's been stung on the planet.
He's saying, you know, when they bring him on the ship.
It killed my wife. Yeah. And all life is of equal value. And who am I to say that this is better than that? And Kirk detonates that argument. Totally detonates it. Blows it clean out of the water. You're like, I'm kind of on board with Peter. And Kirk says, because it's killing my crew.
Right.
Boom. Out of the water. And then he brings the hammer. And not in so many words, what he actually says is, you're so high and mighty, so pure with your ideals of life being equal to this, that, or the other. But isn't it the fact that this thing was like your dog, and you won all the arguments, and it was any woman you wanted it to be, and you were in charge?
It was a convenient.
And it was a convenient, and it served your freaking ego, and you're a dick.
Yep.
It's pretty much what he says, and he's right there, too.
Mm-hmm. Right? Yes.
And if you watch the creature, this is where my sympathy for the creature leaves as I watch the episode, because she has the opportunity to get salt. The Enterprise is there to bring them salt. It will give them salt, but she kills Darnell anyway.
Right.
She cannot control
Her urges,
which is one of the defining things that sets humans apart. We can set aside our instincts. We can say, I want this, but I will not do this. The creature can't. It kills Darnell. It kills two other crewmen. It goes up to the ship. Go to the storeroom. Get yourself a Ketusol, roll it down your little quarters, bathe in this shit. There's no limit to the salt that the replicators can make.
Right.
If they have replicators.
If they have replicators.
But they do make cube food.
They do.
They obviously have cube food. Yeah.
So, that's where the whole, it's a sentient creature and it's on par with us breaks down. It's because the monster can't control its urges. It can't. It's like a dog. And the way it serves Prater, it was like a dog. And the basic argument is a dog's life the same as a person or a crewman's life? Kirk says, fuck no. And in fact, McCoy says the same thing when the creature's trying to kill Kirk. Who's got a better right to live, Kirk or the monster? Well, Kirk, obviously. Number one, he's a man. Number two, he's my friend. So fuck you, salt monster. Eat some phaser. So that's the basic theme of the episode, is the equivalency of different forms of life. And I think they come down on the side that humanity is more important than a salt
monster.
Salt-sucking murderer.
Because I was thinking that the actual lesson, the life lesson that you get from this episode is that if you ever run into a chick that looks a lot like someone you left behind on Wrigley's birthday
party, give her the 20 bucks you owe.
Don't go following her anywhere.
Oh, wow. I was on board with probably what Shelley was saying until, Jeff, you made a really good point there about how about the urges, you know? Like, mankind is able to control that.
That's what Star Trek is all about.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
And the value of humanity over everything.
We won't kill today.
That's right. We'll learn later on. Cringeworthy moment. Reason why people hate Star Trek.
Why people? I don't think there's a lot of that in this episode.
No, there's not.
It's pretty solid.
If anything, it's Sulu's prop.
Sulu's prop.
It's
yeah.
Sulu's prop. It's the set of their planet. And like I say, it's a set that we're going to see a whole lot of.
Yeah, they spackled rock.
They really got their money's worth on that. Yeah, there really isn't a whole lot in this episode.
Yeah, really cringeworthy moments. I suppose the whole James Rand slapping the hand away thing and go chase an asteroid.
That's kind of cringe.
It's a little weak. Yeah. But it's James Rand and she's got a
six-foot-high really cringeworthy. Kirk does kind of go into his classic William Shatnerism delivery there when it's like, it's a creature, it needs salt to live. He does that.
I won't say that. I will say it's classic Shatner action. He runs the serpentine. That's the cringeworthy moment.
Yes.
When they're going after Crater in the rocks and Kirk is coming up to him and he runs from like a non-covered bush that wouldn't absorb any part of a phaser, and he runs serpentine behind his back and rock.
It's pretty much exactly what Tim Allen does in Galaxy Quest.
Yes. There's a reason he makes fun of it.
I actually laughed
when I saw that. I'm like, dude, serpentine.
Yep, we see that a lot too.
Right. That blade of grass is not going to protect
you. Not going to help you a whole lot.
How are you going to rate this episode?
On a scale of from Impulse Engines Only to Warp Factor 9,
where
are you going to give this one?
Jeff?
I would say, I hate to use a cliche, a 7.
A 7.
It's certainly one of the better episodes. It's well constructed. I like it. Not a lot of cringeworthy moments, as we mentioned, other than the serpentine.
Right.
The characters are established before the first commercial break. That's fantastic. And the message is one that pervades Star Trek all through its run in that Humanity is awesome, deserves to be protected and fought for, and a lot of good look at people in space.
Right.
Yeah, no, I agree. I would stick it in a 7. It's a real good, solid episode. It's not one of the greatest. It's not the top of the top, but it's a good, solid episode. Yeah.
I probably have to go with a warp factor 6, probably, on it. And I think that you probably understand once we start watching some of the other ones what ranks as a 7 for me. Nothing, I can't say anything you guys haven't said. It's a very, very solid episode.
Right. There's nothing that
really
establishes.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's not.
There is the space celery.
I mean, like, I think we'll get there, but I mean, like, obviously we have our cities on the edge of forever, Balance of Terror, you know, that's going to be top of the list, but then there's also, like, Miri, you know, that I think I would probably rank a little higher. Yeah, so for me, it's a 6, I think.
Okay.
Shell?
For me, it's an 8, mostly for nostalgia reasons. This is the one of 3 episodes that I watched when I was very young that the images of it just implanted themselves into my brain through adulthood. I have nightmares about that, those rings on people's faces as a child. And they even appear, the skin modeling even appears in my nightmares through my adulthood. So it definitely made an impression on me.
So that's going to do it for the first episode of the Nerd Trap. I'm Josh Look.
I'm Jeff Luce.
I'm Al Rose.
I'm Shelly Rose.
Kiss a girl, be the life.
Get your chili peppers when we get there.
Hey, the Nerd Trap is brought to you by Fortress Ameritrash. Visit us at fortressat.com.
Oh man, it took us this long to come up with a name for a Star Trek podcast. I can't imagine trying to name a Love Boat podcast. You probably could just call it the Love Boat podcast.